From Iowa Public Radio, this is the weekly legislative podcast, Under the Golden Dome. I'm John Pimble.
Senator Sinclair, I just wondered, what took you guys so long?
Democratic Senator Claire Selce asks Republican Senator Amy Sinclair a question, and that's how the debate for K-12 public education funding resumes after a three-week pause.
Sincerely, that's the question.
Point of order has been called. Senator, please state your point.
Senate President Charles Schneider stops the debate so Republican Senator Jake Chapman can explain his point of order.
A question is to be in relation to the bill, not a matter of opinion or length of time for a bill. The question needs to be contained to what we're dealing with.
Senator, your point is well taken. Senator Selce, do you have any points related to the subject matter of the bill?
I thought my question was very specific. I can rephrase.
Why don't you come down to the well,
okay.
Senator?
As is common with a point of order, a senator may have a quick, private meeting with the Senate president to determine how to proceed next. A minute later, Senator Selce resumes questioning Senator Sinclair.
My question is, state law currently states that we have to have this done before now. It's now about 20 days late. Republicans control the House, the Senate, and the governor's office. And I just wondered, you know, what took so long to come to an obvious agreement of 2.3%, which was dead center in the middle.
3 weeks ago, the Senate passed a school state aid spending bill that would increase spending by 2.1%. It was sent to the House, where it passed with an increase of 2.5%, which means the next move is up to the Senate. Until this week, there weren't any indications about a compromise between the two chambers.
We could certainly not run the amendment, which provides for notwithstanding language to notwithstand those 30 days that you mentioned. But then that means that by statute, the increase in supplemental state aid would be zero, Senator, and I don't think any of us in this chamber would like that. As far as the process by the time link, it was a negotiation process. 2.3 was offered, and we were waiting for a response. I guess that's all I've got.
The law states the school appropriation should be signed 30 days after the governor's proposal. It's not unusual for the legislature to be late by days or weeks, and there are no penalties for not meeting the 30-day requirement. Democratic Senator Herman Kornbach says the sooner the legislature decides what the funding will be, the easier it is for school systems to submit their budgets that begin in July.
Their budget has to be approved, I believe, by the middle of April, and there are various public hearing and other requirements, other hoops to jump through along the way.
Schools receive funding from a variety of sources. Even from the state level, there isn't one single spending bill. This year, the legislature has already approved transportation equity increase of $7.6 million and $5.8 million for student equity. But the supplemental state aid is the most significant part of a school's budget, and this proposal is for $85 million. When factoring these three together, the total increase is $99 million. Democratic Senator Jackie Smith says it's not enough this year and hasn't been enough in recent years.
The number one most critical thing is the teacher and the quality of the teacher and the training. And I think that we are not doing our teachers the service that they deserve. They are teaching your kids and your grandkids. And they should be the most revered, most respected profession in this state.
There are other Democratic arguments for more funding. One is to reduce the number of students in a classroom for some schools. But Republican Senator Michael Breitbach says he grew up with large class sizes.
I guess maybe I didn't have a very good education because I had 34 to 36 kids in my classroom all the way from kindergarten until I was in high school. 34 to 36, we had one teacher, no teacher's aide. So I guess I'm just a dumb one. But you know what? I've got classmates that went on. They're engineers. Several. John Deere, 3M. We all got a good education. We went to school to learn, and we learned, and we had great teachers, and we still have great teachers. I think it's disingenuous to accuse them of not being able to teach our kids.
The bill passes in the Senate, and later in the afternoon, the House takes it on. The arguments for more funding continues from House Democratic legislators like Representative Sharon Steckman.
The first 38 years, the state funding never went below 3%, ever. Yet, in this last decade, we have averaged, over the last 10 years, we have averaged 1.67% a year. That does not keep up with inflation, and it does not help our schools become the best they can be.
Democratic Representative Molly Donahue is a teacher and says the proposed increase of $99 million is far less than school districts are asking for.
What our schools told us when they came and told us what they needed, they were asking for about $145 million just to stay above water and to make sure that they didn't lose any more programming.
Republican Representative Cecil Dolacek says this bill, funding from other bills, and by employing techniques in rural areas like whole grade sharing, that's where two or more districts share an education program, all of these things are helping Iowa's public schools.
Many programs of flexibility within the funds to try and support our rural school districts. Some would say that's not adequate, definitely not all that they think is needed, but who knows? That figure is up to each individual person in here. The funding could be unlimited, and to some it still would not be enough.
The House and Senate both pass a 2.3 increase for school state aid. Although the governor requested 2.5%, it is expected she will sign this bill. This is Under the Golden Dome. I'm John Pimble.
A good civics lesson teaches you how to be an engaged citizen, and listening to Under the Golden Dome helps you be an engaged Iowan. When you become a member of Iowa Public Radio, you support coverage that keeps you engaged and informed. Give now at iowapublicradio.org/donate. It takes just a few minutes to make a powerful impact.
Under the Golden Dome is supported by the Iowa Bankers Association and by Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation, fostering causes that enrich the community, generate understanding, and cultivate compassion, including Above and Beyond Cancer.
Many bills have passed from full committees already, but in some cases they are pushed to another committee where they have to start over. Sometimes it's because there is a tax or a budget aspect that needs to be addressed in a committee with that authority. Funding a program is the case with a bill that will help pay for residents of Puerto Rico to move to Iowa. Republican Representative Ray Sorensen chairs an Appropriations Subcommittee.
Thank you all for being here. We'll go around and introduce yourself. Tell us if you're
Since this bill has been through another committee, others have already voiced their thoughts. In this subcommittee, a few speak in support, like Brad Hartkopf from the Iowa Association of Business and Industry.
One of the biggest things holding back our economy is the lack of skilled workers, and anything that we can do to bring more people into the state is a positive thing, and appreciate the public policy offering here to help businesses with relocating expenses from potential employees.
Puerto Rico is an unincorporated territory of the United States in the Caribbean. This bill will pay to move someone from Puerto Rico to Iowa for a job. This bill requires a business to work with the Economic Development Authority to fill a position. Jenny Klein from the Economic Development Authority says her department is registered undecided on this bill, but they have been working with the author.
How we can bring this the first draft of the bill more in line with our other programs, our high-quality jobs, and using the labor shed wage and some other administrative things that would help to ensure that we're getting that the employees and the employers have a good relationship.
Labor shed studies are reports to help understand a region's labor market and wages. This bill says the wage for these new workers must be within two standard deviations of the average wage in the region where a new employee under this program will work.
Why I've identified Puerto Rico for a specific place to go recruit people from is because of the last couple of years they've had, you know, severe natural disasters there.
Republican Representative Joe Mitchell is the author of this bill. He is speaking to this subcommittee.
This is a great way to be able to increase our population as a state, but also increase our skilled workforce. You know, a lot of these people are, you know, mechanical engineers, biotech engineers, EMTs, police officers. I know in Mount Pleasant, we have a staffing agency working with our chamber to bring people from Puerto Rico, and they're bringing EMTs to the hospital, nurses to the hospital. They're bringing 9 processors to our injection molding company we have there.
The idea is for a business to submit a grant to the Economic Development Authority. Once a person is found, the state will provide up to $2,500. The business must match what the state will spend, which means the maximum for a single grant is $5,000.
It's all relocation fees, so some of it would obviously be towards moving people's physical stuff up here and in a plane ticket, of course. But the other money, I assume, would be used to, you know, get people into a house and be able to help them, you know, afford the rent for the first couple months, be able to get them transportation costs, you know, be able to get them the essentials they need once they get up here.
Before this bill came to this appropriations subcommittee, the suggested level of funding was $2 million. But panelist Republican Jacob Bossman says this version is much lower.
The $250,000 appropriation, much smaller than what it was when we were originally discussing. This is more of a pilot project. It'd be a $2,500 matching grant for 100 families. And I think that that's a good place to start. I think that that's a prudent, you know, investment to make, particularly in a pilot perspective for an issue that's of this importance.
Being able to fund 100 jobs instead of the original bill's 800 isn't what Representative Mitchell envisioned, but he says if this works, it should expand.
Make sure this is administered right, and once we've proven that this is a good program, that we can bump those numbers up next year. But I think, you know, I've got suggestions from IEDA and several other groups, and this seems like a good amount to start out with for a pilot project. And if it works, then we can hopefully up the appropriation next year.
As is common during a subcommittee, the chair indicates whether they are supporting the bill or not. Representative Ray Sorensen is this subcommittee's chair.
Well, I think this is a responsibly put together pilot program. I think it makes sense, and Representative Mitchell has done an excellent job working on this and explaining it. So I'm recommending passage, and I encourage my colleagues to do the same.
Representative Bossman and Democratic Representative Mary Masher also sign on, and the bill advances to the full Appropriations Committee. One year ago, during the first half of this 88th Iowa General Assembly, the Senate passed a bill about the non-consensual termination of a human pregnancy. The language was revised to put in the words unborn person where it originally said human pregnancy. Known as the fetal homicide bill, it has a dozen sections with different scenarios of a pregnant woman's unborn child dying and what penalties apply. Now it is before a House Judiciary Subcommittee. Jamie Birch Elliott from Planned Parenthood says the use of the word person makes this a bill related to abortion.
What this law does is treats a fertilized egg as a person in Iowa code. And so that's obviously extreme, that's dangerous, and makes this bill suddenly about abortion, whether that's the intent or not.
Advocates of the bill say the use of the word person is designed to identify the fetus as an individual. A personhood definition often means the zygote becomes a person from the moment of conception. In other bills, this is sometimes used as an attempt to identify abortion as harming a person. Tom Chapman from the Iowa Catholic Conference says this bill is not about abortion.
It completely excludes actions by the pregnant woman from the scope of the legislation. This bill, what it does, it protects unborn human life in the criminal code in contexts other than abortion or medical procedures. So in other words, it deems an unborn baby to actually be a person when offenders attack or otherwise harm a pregnant woman.
The first section states if the unborn person dies during the commission of a forcible felony, the penalty is a Class A felony, which is a life sentence without parole. Daniel Zeno from the ACLU says that's too much.
And so the criminal justice part of this, the penalty part, we think there needs to be significant change, and happy to hear that there might be some work on that part of it. But we oppose the bill.
Tamara Scott from the Iowa Faith and Freedom Coalition and Concerned Women for America of Iowa supports this bill.
For those women who want their babies, for those women whose conception may not have been easy, for families who may have had to go through in vitro fertilization to even have a conception and may have an at-risk pregnancy, but now they're carrying one through and hopefully to term, and to have that taken from them, that hope taken from them, whether it's an accident or in some cases intentional. If it's intentional, you can't find a crime high enough to suit me on this.
There are sections of the bill leading off with a phrase like unintentionally causing the death of an unborn person. When causing the death by driving drunk, for example, the penalty is a Class B felony. Another section says when an act is committed that is likely to cause death, the penalty is a serious misdemeanor. Ann Hoffmaster is an Urbandale resident and asks the panel about a scenario that unintentionally causes death.
Let's say there's a girl that's playing high school basketball. She's in a game. Someone knocks her down. She doesn't realize that she's pregnant, but she is, and that ends up with her not being able to continue with the pregnancy. Is someone supposed to be punished for that? Is that what unintentional covers, or does that not cover it?
Democratic Representative Beth Wessel-Crichel is on this panel, and she does not support this bill.
And it is extreme if there was ever an extreme bill. It does introduce personhood into Iowa code.
This bill is a revision of current Iowa code 707.8 titled Non-Consensual Termination, Injury to Human Pregnancy. Representative Wessel-Crichel says the analysis of this current code by the Legislative Services Agency indicates violations of this law are rare.
Iowa code 707.8, and in the last 10 fiscal years that there have only been four. So this is not like some sort of tragedy that we are trying to, something that's going on all over the place. It's not something that absolutely needs to be addressed. It is clear here that it's rare, and that we are spending our time on something we don't need to spend our time on when we do have some real tragedies. And I am sorry that we are doing this.
Also on this panel is Republican Representative Stan Gustafson. Gustafson's interpretation of other Iowa code is that a conceived child can inherit property. And this opens the way for personhood language in this fetal homicide bill.
And we have it in the Iowa code, the concept of the rule against perpetuities. 557, I think, in section 557 and 558, and that allows a person in the womb to inherit property. And so certainly if a person can inherit property, and there's some other code sections, as were mentioned, I would think that personhood language is appropriate. And I'd be in favor.
The chair of the subcommittee is Republican Representative Dustin Height.
Thank you, everybody, once again for a respectful committee meeting and also your patience in the scheduling issue, and I apologize for that. And with that, we will close the subcommittee. Thank you.
Representative Height signs the bill and says there may be additional amendments about penalties before it comes to the full committee. Representative Gustafson also signs it. This is the weekly legislative podcast, Under the Golden Dome. I'm John Pimble.
Like what you're hearing? Make sure to follow Iowa Public Radio on social media for more episodes and share Under the Golden Dome with your friends. Use the hashtag UTGDPod.
Under the Golden Dome is supported by Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation, and by the Iowa Bankers Association. Helping Iowans reach their financial goals is what Iowa banks are all about. Discover the genuine difference of Iowa banks by following Iowa Bankers on Facebook and Twitter.
In 2019, Governor Reynolds called for a constitutional amendment that would reinstate voting rights for felons who have discharged their sentence. It gained support in the House and was passed. The Senate held a subcommittee last year where everyone agreed to move it forward, but there were some concerns. Now, nearly a year later, the Senate is attempting to ease legislators' concerns by presenting a bill that would go into effect after the constitutional amendment is approved. This bill is presented in the full Senate by Republican Senator Dan Dawson.
Inside of Senate File 2348, the discharge of sentence is broken down into three primary categories. First, if you took a life, if you committed a homicide here in the state of Iowa, the appropriate place for the restoration of a voter right is not on an automatic route, but instead an individual application to the governor. Secondarily, if you raped an individual here in the state of Iowa or committed a sex offense, the appropriate route is not an automatic restoration, but instead an individual application to the governor's office. And finally, there's a whole slew of crimes out there that we're never going to be able to identify one way or the other. We could go through the code book all day and maybe this crime, maybe that crime. But the one thing we are sure of is that the more severe the crime, the more affected a victim is there in the state of Iowa. So the third pillar of this bill is that until you receive your voting rights back, the victim restitution has to be paid in its full.
Democratic Senator Rob Hoeg offers an amendment that states a person who is on a payment plan and making good on their payments would be eligible to have their voting rights restored.
I believe this is important because it addresses this severe disparity that would exist for people based on their financial ability to pay. Rather than having somebody who was born into a lot of family resources being able to pay and get voting rights restored, there are other people who don't have those resources. And as we know, it is very difficult for people who are offenders to be able to then get good jobs to earn the money. And so I think this is important to address that disparity. It is also what Governor Reynolds has signaled very clearly that she is looking for applications currently on voting rights restoration, specifically on her website where she talks about applications for the restoration of voting rights, which she's already constitutionally able to provide. She says the applicant must have completed repayment of court costs, restitution, and fines, or must be current on a payment plan.
But Senator Dawson says if someone becomes a felon, there are hard consequences.
Going out committing a felony is not a random draw in the lottery of life. People make an affirmative decision to go out and commit a crime, and with that, there has to be some consequences. The problem with a payment plan, from a personal standpoint, I think I speak for a lot of individuals in this building here, is that you can go on a payment plan, have your rights restored, and fall right off the next month. And what good do we do there?
Senator Hoeg says his amendment is in line with what the governor has asked for concerning automatically restoring felon voting rights.
We're taking our direction here from what Governor Reynolds has said she'd want. The earth may shake, but I'm going to stand with Governor Reynolds here. I hope maybe there's a Republican in the House that will, in the chamber, who will stand with Governor Reynolds and support Amendment 5043 to allow a payment plan option on the restitution. With that, Mr. President, I move Amendment 5043 and I ask for a record.
The amendment fails. This debate for the rest of the bill is not lengthy. Senator Dawson says in the last year, there have been many conversations on how to proceed, and that includes with activists he disagrees with.
Some of these social justice warriors have been an embarrassment here this last 13 months. Absolute embarrassment.
As is common for many issues, advocates on both sides of an issue often approach legislators during the session, attend committee meetings, and sometimes hold gatherings in the Capitol to rally their cause. During Senator Dawson's lengthy closing remarks, he says felons have been brought to the Capitol by groups to oppose this kind of bill.
It's kind of interesting because in some ways, the felons looking for a restoration of their rights has been more reasonable and more thoughtful than the advocates who have been allegedly fighting for them. What do I mean by that? We've talked about this bill with the felons out there. A lot of them said, yeah, I don't want to be associated with that rapist. I don't want to be associated with that murder. I just got a couple of pops for marijuana, or I had multiple OWIs, or something along those lines there, or whatnot. One felon even said, yeah, I believe actually the victim should be paid back first. But you listen to the debate, oh my gosh. Everyone needs an automatic restoration, carte blanche. No ifs, ands, or buts. Which I find kind of humorous a little bit, because on the one hand, the group's bringing felons up here to make a personal connection, and when you look at the expression on the face of these group leaders, when the felons actually talk and say they agree with some aspects of this bill, it's absolute horror on their face. which I find kind of ironic a little bit. So on the one hand, you're bringing a convicted felon up here to advocate for voting rights, which we're trying to find a resolution here through this bill. But on the other hand, they're too stupid and they don't actually know what they want. Irony can be pretty ironic.
Dawson cites an example of a murderer and a child molester for those who should not automatically have their voting rights restored. He says an automatic restoration does not always consider the victims of a crime.
No one has been able to offer me a reason why those persons need an automatic restoration of voting rights. I've heard a lot of concerns about the disparity between rich and poor and paying back the victim restitution. That line of thinking, I believe, is personally insulting to poor people out there, because there's a whole lot of people with lower incomes that don't commit felonies.
Dawson says automatically restoring voting rights for people convicted of rape is wrong.
What are we saying to the rape victims out there down the road when their perpetrator gets out and she shows up at a voting booth? That rape victim probably hasn't felt comfortable going in a public bathroom the last 10, 15, 20 years. But what we're trying to say here to them in the state of Iowa is we need to adopt some altruistic attitude that it's actually better for the person to show up the voting booth with you. And giving that felon, that rapist, or that murderer an equal say in electing your upper officials who, by the way, make criminal law.
This bill passes the Senate with all Republicans voting for, as well as six Democrats. Governor Kim Reynolds has encouraged her system of having a person be on a payment plan while having their voting rights to be the process. But a few hours before the Senate debate we just heard, she says she can support their measure.
My main priority is to keep the amendment clean, and we're so far able to do that through the statute. I have said before that I didn't want to make it more complicated. They've really tied the restitution to victims, and we should never, ever lose sight of victims. So like court fines and things like that wouldn't be a part of it. So I'm going to continue to watch it, and really, hopefully, we can get the support that we need to, if we get this passed and sent over to the House, we'll see what they do, and then hopefully the amendment to the Constitution will be the next thing through. So compromise is part of that's how we get things done. When you show no willingness to compromise, then nothing ever happens. So we'll continue to work with them and see what happens.
With the passage in the Senate, this bill can now make its way to the House after it goes through a committee process. If the House approves, it's up to the Senate to pass the constitutional amendment. This bill will only become law if the constitutional amendment also passes again in the next General Assembly and is voted on by the public before the end of 2022. It's not legal for a barbershop to be mobile like in a bus or a van, but a bill passed both the Senate and House removing this restriction. The governor has advocated for this change. She singled out a barber from Waterloo who already made a mobile barbershop as an example of a business person who can benefit from this bill. That barber, William Burt, is also a convicted felon whose voting rights she recently restored. Reynolds has also appointed Burt to serve on the Iowa Board of Barbering. That approval is subject to Senate confirmation. Under the Golden Dome is part of a large effort from Iowa Public Radio to cover the State House during the legislative session. There are more stories from State House reporter Katerina Sestarik and reporter Grant Gerlach from iowapublicradio.org. Their work also helps keep this show on track. Script editor for this episode is Michael Leland. He's Iowa Public Radio's news director. Digital team support comes from Matt Siren and Lindsay Moon. Good advice about all things legislative comes from Radio Iowa's Kay Henderson. Also some help from the many reporters working at the Capitol during the estimated 100 days of the 2020 session. Our show could use a mention in your social media feed, so do that. Use the hashtag UTGDpod. I'm John Pimble. Under the Golden Dome is a production of Iowa Public Radio.